This is a good old song called I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground. Sometimes you ain't what you think you want to be, but dadgummit, be satisfied, because you ain't what you don't want to be, and if you ain't what you don't want to be, you don't want to be something you ain't. That's good English for you, boy. This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Every week, the Old Mole brings you interviews, reviews, cultural commentary, social political analysis, music and art from a radical intersectional socialist feminist perspective. That's radical, as in going to the root. Intersectional, as in seeing the system as a set of intersecting systems of oppression. And socialist feminist, as in being grounded in a collective perspective that cares. You can listen to the show every week, Monday morning, 9 to 10 a.m., or you can go back and listen to any show in its entirety or as individual segments by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. To lead off our show, Bill Resnick is going to be talking with Marty Hart Landsberg again about what a Green New Deal can learn from the original New Deal of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Desiree Hellegers is going to be talking with Cowlitz Tribal Chair Bill Lyle about the status of the fights against the proposed Crystal Geyser water plant and mining in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, with additional perspective from Cowlitz activist Terry Graves. Denise Morris returns with movie mole and resident psychologist Jan Hawken to discuss themes of mental health in Joker. Before we turn to Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg, I'd like to make a special request that people reach out to join the Old Mole Variety Hour. There are no real requirements besides KBOO orientations and trainings and jiving with our intersectional socialist feminist perspective against capitalism. You could be on air doing book or movie reviews. You could be talking to people from a radical organization, sharing stories of people solving their problems collectively, elevating marginalized perspectives and experience in history, and questioning dominant paradigms. You could be discussing psychology and philosophy pertinent to liberation and oppression. You could read poetry, offer an analysis of a significant social phenomena. You could share field recordings from actions that happen in the Portland area. You could also be a host, like I'm doing today, right now. Hosts announce the show, and they also organize the show, working with the contributors for the show to find out what they're doing so that it can be promoted before the show and properly described during the show. But there's also a creative license in being able to come up with the content between segments, including music and your own comments about what's on the show. You could make live radio, or you could pre-record with KBOO's professional quality recording studios. But if you don't want to be on air for whatever reason, there's a lot that happens off the air that makes the Old Mole happen on air. For example, after the show broadcasts, we post it to the KBOO website, meaning that we log into KBOO's website and use a webpage generator to put the words, links, pictures, and of course audio content onto a webpage. We post the whole show, and we cut up the audio and post them as individual segments so that you can find just the thing you want to listen to or share something that's very important. That might take 1 or 2 hours. Or if you want to make live radio but not be on the radio, you can come and operate the soundboard in the air room. KBOO requires you be trained, but they offer the training. And if you like the idea of being able to think aloud about things going on in the world, but you just don't really know whether you can do it, you're in luck, because we will help you along the way. KBOO offers its classes on audio production and using the equipment and knowing the law surrounding radio broadcast. but we as a collective will personally mentor you and guide you in both navigating the community resources of KBOO and the actual execution of making a segment of doing radio on the Old Mole. If any of this appeals to you, please reach out to us by emailing us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you could call the KBOO main office at 503-231-8032 and leave a message with your contact information. With that said, without further ado, we turn to Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg, continuing their conversation from last week with Marty Hart Landsberg about the Green New Deal and lessons from the original New Deal, which in the 1930s had only begun to pull the U.S. out of the Depression, which only ended with the great mobilization of all resources and person power to fight World War II. The second part discusses how the Depression movements strengthened during the war and then won most of the New Deal programs we know, including Social Security and unemployment insurance. They also discuss how today's Green New Deal must confront a capitalist crisis that cannot be solved by jump-starting growth. We must quickly move to a very different economic model.
And so what happened is Roosevelt, who thought that his first New Deal might satisfy, was now being faced with not only continued unemployed organizing demanding relief and jobs, relief workers organizing demanding improvement and relief, and a labor movement that was now demanding unions, and in fact, all of those movements.
Wages, jobs, shorter hours, minimum wage, unemployment insurance.
Yeah, and also showing that when you launch a general strike, you're saying the rules are no longer going to be the rules. That it's essentially saying workers are going to be establishing and determining what power looks like. And the same with unemployed organizing and relief organizing who are engaging in strikes, disregarding laws, challenging the police and the courts. And it was this kind of pressure that led Roosevelt, with his advisor saying to him, something has to be done in 35 to launch what was called the Second New Deal.
Or we're going to have a revolution in this country.
This is the danger.
Yes.
So the question is then, from a Green New Deal point of view, how do you prepare people right now to understand how real significant change unfolds? It wasn't that the movement said, well, the capitalists are against us, let's ask for just a little with the hopes that we can expand it. Rather, it was a movement that demanded something meaningful, like real job creation, real relief, real Social Security. And when it didn't get it, it was able to continue to build, to continue to demand those things.
Yeah. And that led then to Roosevelt's second term, where, and we can call it, you call it the Second New Deal, I guess that's what the literature calls it. A lot of programs were passed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that, like, let's say, the minimum wage was passed in 1938, Fair Labor Standards Act. Mm-hmm. The minimum wage then was 25 cents an hour, the federal minimum wage. No states or anybody else had a minimum wage. 25 cents an hour was not enough even then to buy food. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it only covered 20% of the workers.
Yeah.
Well, they had a minimum wage, but it affected almost nothing.
Yeah.
And the Social Security was exactly the same. They were forced to pass a Social Security, but why don't you discuss the limitations?
I think this is where it becomes complicated, because these were path-breaking programs. Before Roosevelt, the government had never assumed responsibility for relief or job creation, had never invested in a Social Security system or even a system of labor laws and regulations protecting workers. So on the one hand, these were victories. On the other hand, the movement was well aware that what they got was not what they were asking for. So even when you think of the WPA, which has built post offices and all these wonderful things.
And Timberline Lodge.
Yep, the WPA paid wages below the market because they didn't want to draw people from the private sector. They refused to engage in any production that would challenge private activity or private markets. And they also continued to demand that the only people who could be eligible were people who were seen as financially needy, which meant that they had, much like our welfare system today, lots of punitive evaluations of finance. The government did pass a Social Security, but it was pushed because there was a bill that had actually come out of a House Congress that the left had supported that said everybody, whether they were unemployed or old or injured, should get paid an amount that was equivalent to kind of a living wage. And it was from the moment that they were unemployed or injured or reached a certain old age, and that the federal government would finance it. And that would be an unemployment system and a Social Security system, and they would be integrated, and they would be financed by taxes on the wealthy. What Roosevelt, when he saw that bill come into Congress,
that's un-American.
He immediately asked his own people to write a different Social Security bill that he could pass. And so what you got was unemployment and Social Security that wouldn't start for about 6 years. Here we are in the middle of the Depression. That from the point of view of unemployment was a given based on how much you had earned in your lifetime and how long you worked, which worked against people striking. And Social Security, again, was tied to your earnings and limited in certain ways. So in each of these kinds of things, the movement did succeed. They did make the country better. They did make the country fairer. But one of the lessons is, even in this period of massive uprising with a government that you might think is sympathetic, the response was always limited. And unfortunately, for reasons that, you know, become complicated, the movement, partly dictated by changing politics, the war, the movement wasn't able to go on and push to make changes in those. And so as a consequence, we ended up with a Social Security system that never fulfilled its promise and, of course, is under attack now. And we lost.
This was before the war, though, and before the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
When, in fact, Social Security became meaningful, because those movements continued.
Well, it basically, you know, it evolved from the Roosevelt plan, which never reached the promise of what the political movements were really had written in a bill that would have created a much more stable, secure system that would be financed by wealthy people, not working people, self-financing. So, you know, what's the importance here is that those who are advocating a Green New Deal often project all sorts of policies. We need governments to channel funds. We need to think about support programs for agriculture. We need new mass transit vehicles and new mass transit systems. We need new tax systems. And
we need radical conservation of energy. We need a new forestry. We need regenerative agriculture, radically changing the agribusiness practices. It's so very radical program,
actually. And it's going to require changes in every sector of our economy and our lives.
And our lives,
so then the question is, in the 30s, there was a very clear crisis of people's living conditions, and an unemployed movement was able to grow and project its power in particular ways. Now we face the question, how do houseless people organize? How do hungry people organize? How do farmers organize? What are the ways in which people were able to organize and create a national framework? We don't have one party, like, say, the Communist Party or the Socialist Party or the Mustaites, but we do have ways of linking together. And when you go back to the 30s and start thinking about these things, we can begin to sort of become aware of the challenges we face and start thinking about how we build movements in constituencies of people who need to be part of the process of change. And how do we create overall frameworks that allow them to begin to make changes locally, but push power up so that the needs we have begin to exercise control? And how do we create a movement that knows the lessons of the 1930s, that is going to be continual pressure in making demands and holding governments accountable to get the kind of transformative policies we want? It's not a matter of just writing the policy and electing some progressive government of leadership that's going to do this. That the lessons of the 30s can teach us about how to prepare for the back and forth of state policy, the challenges of what slogans do you use? How do you connect people together? How do you assuage their fears? How do you create context for people, in fact, most importantly, to understand why they're in the precarious position that they're in?
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marty Hart Landsberg, who has a distinguished career at Lewis and Clark, wrote many important books, and does a blog now. He's still very, very active in Portland organizations, Jobs with Justice and Portland Rising. We've been talking about the lessons of his latest contribution on his blog on the economic front.
It's reports from the economic front.
Reports from the economic front.
Right. So
I always put Marty Hart Landsberg economic front.
Right.
I get
that, that will get it.
I get it. Anyway, we've been talking about the lessons of the New Deal, the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Well, we didn't get quite to the 50s on the New Deal. And the way that it developed and the demands from below, from huge amounts of organizing with affected workers and non-affected workers, even people with jobs, but it was a vast undertaking and organizing project that continued and built multiple organizations in many areas making demands. It was after the war, though, the Depression never ended until Pearl Harbor. And then the U.S. entered the war. There was this mobilization. They drafted huge numbers of people. Everybody in the U.S. had a job. Yeah. The defense plants were booming, going 24 hours a day. They nationalized the auto industry, basically. No more cars were being built. Right. They were building tanks and planes. With new people, a lot of the auto workers were abroad fighting the war. Mm-hmm. Lots of women who everybody thought they can't work, or they're just housewives. You know, that's the order of things. Suddenly, all these blacks were getting jobs too. Poor black people from the South came here, came up north to finally get a decent job in the... In fact, in Portland, in the Kaiser, what do they build? Boats.
Shipyards.
In the shipyards. Suddenly, all of them, the whole of you, they were dying for labor. Everybody got a job who could walk upright. Mm-hmm. And these were people who were thought to be just hopeless and useless. That's why we have unemployment in the United States, said the capitalists. These people just are unemployable. They haven't taken the opportunities of American life. Suddenly, they all became employable, and they became this sort of they built the industry that beat the Nazis, basically. Mm-hmm. Huge defense plants and were built and staffed by people who had never ever have any education whatsoever, actually. In any event, the war sort of took the U.S. out of the Depression. But after the war, all of these laws that were so inadequate to stop the Depression through the Roosevelt period suddenly became the movements remained. The labor movement was, of course, had grown during that period, and they were under attack, including the labor movement is one that didn't, in fact, benefit after the war in the 50s. The Taft-Hartley Act was, labor was cut back. The Congress is doing everything they could to stop workers from organizing, even though the organizing continued. But many other programs were tremendously expanded, right? The movements kept struggling. Democratic politicians, the New Deal politicians, had learned that the people want these movements and that we can afford them. Social Security became real. Unemployment insurance became real. The minimum wage even became real.
Well, I would agree, but I would modify it a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, but the main point you're making is, though, that I do agree fully that the New Deal did not solve the Great Depression. In fact, in 1937, the economy went down in 29 to a low point in 33, and then it where unemployment was like 28%, and it went up from 33 to 37 to the high point where unemployment was only like 15%. And then Roosevelt said, well, okay, now we can cut back spending. Still that conservative balanced yeah. budget. It shows how difficult it is to change ideology, that the elites really hold on to a kind of vision of the world that benefits them. And so he tightened up, and the economy went back into a recession where unemployment hit about 20% by 38, and Roosevelt finally agreed to start spending. But even by 1940, unemployment was still like about 12 or 15%. So, the economy was certainly better than it was in 29, and there were certainly now some programs that ameliorated some of the worst, but it was far from out of the woods. But it was the buildup for the war and then the war that really brought the massive deficits and spending and brought the economy out of the Depression. And I think part of that also meant that a lot of these movements, these really mass movements, lost their connections, their strength, their alternative vision. I mean, the war provided, you know, different opportunities for employment, so the unemployed movement and the relief movement went away. And the more radical edge to the labor movement, which was really pushing with a different vision of worker control and how industry should operate,
got put in jail.
Pushed out as part of the Cold War.
Right.
But also, more conservative leaders could say, yeah, "There's no need for that. Look how well the system functions."
At that period, the system was functioning for average workers. That was a period where a unionized manufacturing worker could buy a home, which that was another program of that the U.S. was forced into, of guaranteeing low mortgage rates for people to buy homes. They realized that it was smart to have people home ownership rather than rentals. It sort of kept... It was stabilizing for the economy. It's really good. That's what they say, you know, we need a middle class that's stabilizing. Well, this isn't a middle class. It was a working class, but it was a working class that was able to buy homes and a car and send their kid to the local university on one salary, a manufacturing worker. Yeah. That's all gone. I mean, it's been destroyed over the years. Mm-hmm. But in that period, it's sort of called, I think, by some economists, the golden age for the working class. Mm-hmm. It lasted until the late 70s, before the terrible cut, before capital really took over, regained power again, and managed to divert all income streams to itself. Mm-hmm. Right? Since 73, workers have declined.
Yep.
Anyway, but it seems to me that you could see why it was difficult to employ people when they were out taking a 2-week vacation when they were going out to the beach on weekends and playing in their little leagues and having this whole life and moving to the suburbs. Of course, blacks were another matter. This was the white working class that was doing better, but even some blacks were able to sort of stabilize their communities in that period. And they were under enormous attack, of course. But you could see why the movements declined. I mean, then for so many reasons, conservative people took over the labor movement.
Sure. Well, and that's where, I mean, I'm absolutely right. And so that's why some of the demands for direct public employment, which were part of the popular movement's demands, which were not really fully realized in the WPA, but we're still on the agenda, get lost. That's why, you know, some of the more radical notions of the labor movement get lost. That doesn't mean that the period of the New Deal was inconsequential, which I know you're not saying. And so there is a reason why we can look back and say popular movements can shift state policy in substantial ways. The Roosevelt administration was forced to innovate and experiment in certain ways. The system is powerful, and there were limits on what even Roosevelt desired to do. But one of the lessons that we can learn when we're facing this big crisis is that movement building has the potential to shift policy. Governments won't shift policy on their own, and it's not a smooth process. And so again, I go back to the Green New Deal and the excitement. It's so inspiring to see people come out and demand a Green New Deal and to be in the streets. But to really have the political force to push a transformative set of state policies is going to take organizing. And those are the kinds of challenges that people who are in movements now or who are in communities trying to join people together have to start thinking about, because it's not that we're going to recreate exactly what other people did, but many of the challenges are the same. How do you find times to connect people? How do we do actions that, in the context of the action, educate people on why they're so precarious, why different ways of living will be superior? What are the obstacles? What are the class forces opposing these things? How do we begin to project a different vision? And that's where I think the New Deal period has a lot to teach us, not to romanticize it, but not to dismiss it, but to see a period in U.S. history of massive organizing under very difficult circumstances that succeeded in transforming a political environment.
Marty Hart Landsberg, that's the last word. We learned a lot about the necessity of organizing now, of the unwillingness of the capitalist class to give much, but they can, in fact, be forced to give something, and sometimes those things that they give are models of a very, very different future, and that's what could happen, it seems to me, at least in this period. We may not, in fact, get what we want, but we will get some of what we want, and we will get models of what we want. Those models are already being developed, yes, in some cities and around the country.
It's very important.
And when the crisis then hits again, it could hit soon, but we do have the power to create these models now and these programs, real operating models, yeah, of energy production, of agriculture, yeah, in every sphere, actually, buildings.
Yeah. And I think that's worthy of celebrating, that the notion of a Green New Deal, whatever people mean by it, has really taken root and is inspiring people to think about different ways of living and working and relating in all these spheres. And I think that's something to really build on and to celebrate.
You know, we have to just keep fighting for those radical programs, because we can, in fact, win many of the elements of what would be a really transformed society. And it's necessary.
Yep, absolutely. Because it is a crisis.
Because
and if we can't solve it in a positive way, we are going to be continuing to suffer, more of us, more seriously.
And maybe, in fact, wind up with humans no longer on the planet if we don't stop climate change. Capital is in deep, deep trouble. They either have to be transformed, or we're probably going to suffer far more than we ever could imagine, in fact, even that Hollywood imagines. Martin Hart Landsberg, oh, I grabbed the last word. You want the last word, right?
No, go for it.
Is that all right? I didn't want to end on that, though. That's, in fact, one possibility. The other possibility is something really a transformed society in very, very interesting and democratic
and
ways.
And transform people in the process, and that really can make for a new world real in ways that I think most of us, and certainly all of KBOO listeners, would want.
Once again, go to reports from the economic front. It was great talking to you.
Thanks. I appreciated the chance to talk with you about this, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Bill Resnick having a bit more conversation with Marty Hart Landsberg about what the original New Deal of the 30s and 40s and 50s has to teach us about pursuing a Green New Deal today. Up next, Desiree Heiliger speaks with Cowlitz Tribal Chair Bill Lyle, as well as Cowlitz Tribal activist Terry Graves, about the exploratory mining in the Gifford-Pinoche National Forest and the fight to stop a crystal geyser plant on the Cowlitz River.
This past Wednesday, I spoke by phone with Bill Iall, chairman of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, about the exploratory drilling that's going on in the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest in close proximity to the Goat Rocks Wilderness area, which carries particular cultural significance for the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. The drilling by the Canadian-owned mining company, Ascot USA, was permitted by the U.S. Forest Service in February 2018.
Yeah, that is a very important area. This is the Upper Green River watershed. It's a pristine watershed with virtually no modern impacts in the watershed beyond there. There's commercial harvest of timber up there, but virtually it's untouched. It's undammed water. It's tremendous habitat for the fisheries there. And maybe on the lower Columbia, it may be one of the more important tributaries providing unimpacted habitat. But beyond that, the risk of open-pit mining in our historic area there, a sacred area near Mount St. Helens, right adjacent to the traditional cultural property that is called Mount St. Helens for the Cowlitz and the Yakima people. It's critical that we limit this activity up there, and especially the risk of open-pit mining is frightening. Those industries are fraught with difficulty, and they leave a horrible mess. And the regulatory climate for mining, whether it's copper, gold, silver, diamonds, or whatever they're looking for, those laws are 120 120, 150 years old in some cases. So they're not aimed towards protection of any resources.
I know there's concerns also that there might be kind of toxic sludge ponds that could be constructed if open pit mining were allowed there. And it sounds like while exploratory drilling might sound relatively benign, that simply the permitting of exploratory drilling may be an important step toward getting approval for the actual mining.
Yeah, the other thing it does is, they're hoping to find something. Whatever they find could drive the process even further and deeper into the process. And this land was acquired many years ago for conservation and recreation. And clearly that's not going to happen if there is any kind of mining effort there. It's going to take it out of that use for the next 100 years if there's any kind of mining activity. So this is a greater community concern, and we have worked with the local community on this as well. Since I know I've talked to Senator Cantwell and Senator Murray about this issue over the years, and we've worked with the local county commission, and we think there's better use for this land for the local community as well as the entire country and the general population. Public awareness is the most critical element in many of these cases here, and if there was a way to shift the land use here to strictly conservation and public use and recreation, then I think that's what we should do, and the Congress has the power to do that.
We spoke also about the tribe's involvement in a fight against the siting of a Crystal Geyser bottling plant in Randall, Washington, that would bottle an estimated 350,000 gallons a day of water from the Cowlitz River.
So it's an important water source for much of the southwest Washington. The local wells and such rely on that aquifer. More importantly, the initial amount that they specified is not certainly not likely the ultimate amount that they would be going for. I'm not sure what their limitations would be, but other than I believe they look at it as a hydraulic question rather than a question of water quality, and we're very concerned about the water quality issue. Primarily, this spring water is cold water that feeds the river, especially at low water time when the water temperatures are very high. The fish rely on the cooler water from the springs and the aquifer just for their survival. And so the Cowlitz tribe is speaking on their behalf as much as we are the other parts of our community there.
Right. And this is, coming pretty close on the heels of the major battle out in Cascade Locks regarding Nestle's bottled water plants. So it sounds like there was a significant setback for Crystal Geyser when some internal memos that they had written about, their plans for forcing this plant through in the face of tremendous community resistance actually was inadvertently emailed to a reporter. And
it just exemplifies the corporate tactic in this industry. They are quick to highlight any deficiencies in the public water systems, the municipal water systems, and rightfully so. People need to be concerned about their municipal water, but the municipal water is highly regulated with regard to water quality, whereas bottled water is not that regulated, and they're almost self-regulated in many ways. So if there is a breach of water quality in a public source, it's immediately known. And likely, though, if there was a breach of water quality in a bottle plant, no one would ever know about it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's, they're taking advantage of those issues and many of the underserved and disadvantaged communities rely on public water, but they also, I think their water service is probably less critical as far as the maintenance and the upkeep. And I think as a community, as a society, we need to put an emphasis on, more emphasis on reusable containers and municipal water. As I understand it, these bottled water plants utilize the majority of that water comes from municipal water, and so it creates a huge single-use waste train of plastic bottles that ultimately find their way into the environment. Much of it goes into the water, and even that plastic can find its way into a river and be ground into tiny particles, and it can appear in the ocean. And I've read now that we're not that far away from a time when there'll be more plastic in our oceans than there are fish now. So I think it's a major, maybe a time to rethink how we utilize our vital water resources and try to protect them better and put more emphasis on reuse and reclaim, but also avoid the single-use bottle water containers as much as possible.
So they're also talking about a bottling plant about the size of a Walmart with its own ecological footprint, with trucks coming and going and other disruptions to the ecosystem and to the community.
Yeah, and this plant does exemplify that just the massive production that it takes to put water in a bottle and move it in trucks up and down our freeways that are already jammed, and hauling this water to its market source somewhere far away from the Cowlitz River. And that's why we're fighting to keep our precious resource here, but also we'd like to see a societal shift away from the plastic bottle use, and we're certainly working everywhere we can to do that as well.
On Friday, I spoke with Terry Graves, an enrolled Cowlitz tribal member, a former park ranger at Mount Rainier and the Grand Canyon, who's been actively involved in the fight against Crystal Geyser.
You got involved in this campaign in May or June, which is when the first organizing meetings happened. Can you talk a little bit about some of the concerns that you brought to this campaign?
Absolutely. Thanks for having us, and thanks for getting this information out there. Speaking on behalf of myself as a concerned member of the tribe, but not speaking on behalf of the tribe, several of us, that you know, we kind of gather that information, we go to the tribe, we introduce that information to them so then they can research and find out more information. Went to this meeting, and one of the concerns that we had when I learned about what was happening was with Crystal Geyser draining 400 gallons a minute was the proposed plan. 24 hours a day, it would drop the aquifer, drop the river temperatures, and affect our salmon. We also had concerns as indigenous people of the area. As native people, we don't work harder, we work smarter. And there's springs in the area, there's known to be village sites in the area, and along with that, we have burial sites in that area as well. So we had concerns about that, the heavy construction, the draining of the river, and just the fact that it would affect the environmental area of our indigenous lands. Just an amazing meeting, really supportive, have huge allies, made great friends with people that live in that area and love that area of Randall as we do.
And this is the meeting that kind of gave birth to the Lewis County Water Alliance, which has been kind of a big participant in the fight.
It did. There was standing room in the fire hall, and they had to actually set up speakers outside the fire hall so people could hear what was going on. I believe they think there was about 300 people in attendance at that meeting. The people of the area had concerns regarding not only the salmon like we had concerns of, but they also had concerns that with the draining of the aquifer, that it would drop their wells and they would have to totally redig a new well. You can't take a current well and just dig deeper, you have to start all over, and the cost that would be incurred to them. Other people actually had concerns about the noise, the traffic, and Crystal Geyser was really kind of sneaky. They came in and purchased the property for three times its assessed value, started permitting and asked with the Department of Ecology for test drilling sites for the springs. And so some people living across the street for where those test drillings were happening started to ask questions, and so that's where it kind of stemmed from.
It sounds like you accumulated a lot of perspective and organizing insights from the fight Cascade Locks against the Nestle's bottling plant there.
Yes, we had a couple representatives that came from Cascade Locks, and they wanted to share their kind of playbook that they had, helping us fight that fight. There's other places as well besides Cascade Locks. They won that battle there. An email that was sent accidentally by Crystal Geyser to a reporter of the Chronicle stating that they're looking for their unicorn site, the perfect site where nobody will be upset about us, I guess is how you can interpret that. But we found that there's also Crystal Geyser has some kind of not so great practices. They're owned by a pharmaceutical company in Japan. Currently, like Weed, California, their water rights with Crystal Geyser pretty much draining and affecting a sacred Mount Shasta down there.
Where they're taking about a million gallons a day from the area around Mount Shasta.
Yeah, I'm really hoping what we're doing in Lewis County there and working with the Water Alliance and the tribe opposing that Crystal Geyser plant is that it's going to set a precedent for just bottled water in general. One of the things that I always try to preach to people is that, you know, it's about convenience versus the next seven generations of our people. And so carry a reusable water bottle, fill it up. If it's with you, don't think about purchasing water. I've also learned from some military friends that they're being instructed that water is the next big oil. And so real concerns on protecting our waters here in Washington State and the Pacific Northwest in general and keeping them safe for our generations here and for our land and for our four-legged relations, our elk, our deer, you know, our fish people, our salmon people, our smelt.
And I think this goes to the question of how can non-native people act in solidarity. Perhaps we should really be looking at removing bottled water machines across the board from public buildings so that we are not collaborating in the privatization of water and that in many cases is coming from indigenous lands.
Absolutely. I was really proud at our last Cowlitz powwow this last 19th of October. And the powwow committee, I had talked to them about this, and they had refill stations for the dancers, for the drummers, for the bottled water was very limited. Definitely the Crystal Geyser water was removed from our gas station at the casino at Alane. And so really kind of being open and thinking about that. It's one step. We understand that it's, you know, the big bottled water that you have for water coolers, those can be reused, you know, refilled. Single use, it's damaging our oceans, our orca, our salmon, you know, we call orca the blackfish, Puget Sound's being affected. Does orca travel the West Coast? And so they're affected by the Columbia River and our Cowlitz River as well.
Right, and we saw Taliqua carrying her dead infant for what?
Yeah, I think it was 17 days.
17 days.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been speaking today with Bill Iall, chairman of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and Cowlitz activist Terry Graves. Contact information for the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, you can go to the website cowlitz.org. The website for the Lewis County Water Alliance is saveourvalley.org. And for more information on mining in the Gifford Pinchot Wilderness Area, go to cascadeforest.org. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Desiree Helligers speaking with Bill Lyle and Terry Graves. As an addendum, in August, the Lewis County Board of Commissioners passed a temporary short-term moratorium on water extraction in the county while they study the impacts. And up next, to finish our show, Denise Morris returns to the film Joker that she reviewed last week with Victoria Saucedo. She's going to talk with movie mole and resident psychologist Jan Hocken a bit more about the film, focusing on its themes of mental health and wellness and social disorder.
Last week on The Old Mole, Victoria Saucedo and I reviewed The Joker, the much-talked-about film by Todd Phillips, co-written by Scott Silver. We discussed the film as a character study, not just of Arthur Fleck, who becomes Joker, but of the nature of American austerity and the ravages it leaves in its wake. We argued that Joker is very much a cautionary tale and a commentary on our troubled times. Jan, you are a clinical psychologist and have experience with some of the diagnostic questions that people have been posing around this film.
Well, a number of mental health providers have weighed in various reviews on their diagnostic impressions of the Joker, and that itself is kind of an interesting phenomenon, how and when mental health diagnoses enter into popular culture. I think it was effective, that the ambiguity of his diagnosis, that his diagnosis was never clear. He was positioned as someone who was not being helped through medication and was being failed by the system. But there were a number of factors that contributed to his undoing, and I think the film was pretty effective in that way. I did a film a few years back following people who came into the Oregon State Hospital through the insanity plea, through a crime. And most of them, over the course of their hospitalization, had had 8 to 10 diagnoses. And that's often true in the history of psychiatry in general, that people have many diagnoses. There's kind of a diagnosis. They're often fads or some that seem destigmatized, like PTSD, bipolar disorder, kind of ascended and replaced some of the schizophrenias of years back. Often the diagnosis is a way of distilling or reducing people to criteria that themselves are very narrow from the start. One of those important distinctions that has been discussed, and I think often affects how people are sympathetic with the character in a film, is this person psychopathic? Is this person a sociopath or a psychopath? Or are they really psychotic? Are they really, quote, mentally ill? And that itself is a problematic distinction, because often if the person is cast as sociopathic or suffering from a condition that they still have some capacity for reality testing, then they lose sympathies. And here I think there was something about this character and his vulnerability and his suffering that no matter how you might frame what was wrong with him, held you to him over the course of the film.
I felt like in a lot of the articles that the cart came before the horse, because we actually see Arthur as someone who's experiencing violence and has experienced a certain amount of mistreatment in his day-to-day relations and is vulnerable and precarious in his job and in his world and in the company that he keeps, which is very little. We also see him with his mother taking care of her. We see a person who's appears to be very functional, and yet many of the reviewers began the story with him being in this state of acting violent.
There has been some commentary on how people with a serious mental disorder, something in the psychoses or serious condition, are more apt to be victimized. People seem odd to others. And of course, his lack of control over his emotion or his affect, this disturbance he had, made him very odd to others. And I thought that was effective, that there was an oddness about him that was hard to diagnose, but led to him being bullied and victimized, and that much of the revenge he took on people around him was also quite selective. It wasn't just random violence, and it became targeted, of course, on his mother, the wealthy people who had betrayed him.
So, and people who were also trying to harm others. One of the main events happens on the train with three men harassing a woman, and this becomes the beginning of his cycle, so to speak.
And that's where he does register as a kind of folk hero, and there's some history of madness as a kind of folk hero rising up and not being constrained by social norms and kind of acting out the grievances of the masses. I have heard people comment that, well, here we have a sympathetic character because we learn he's been traumatized by his mother. So he doesn't have a biologically or genetically based disorder. We learn that his madness and unraveling comes out of a very cruel and neglectful mother. And often that's the forced choice, that it's either biology or environmental or some kind of trauma born of a harsh environment. And I think it's easy to forget how much the feminist movement within mental health in the 60s and 70s rejected that idea of the schizophrenogenic mother or the refrigerator mother, which was, when I was being trained as a psychiatric nurse in the 60s, that was kind of the dominant model of psychosis, that people became crazy because they had a very abusive or neglectful mother, or a mother that was too fused, you know, and there was a lot of that here, a seductive mother that treated the boy especially as an extension of her own body. So it was sort of a kind of flashback for me of earlier vision of psychiatry, but it didn't settle on any one formulation, which was kind of nice. I mean, it wasn't like, aha, now this is finally, we've gotten to it. But I think it's important to understand the history of various explanations for madness and the baggage they carry, including the idea of the schizophrenogenic or traumatogenic mother, which was, I think, a part of this story.
One of the interesting insights a reviewer had in The Guardian was Arthur, following some beatings in the street while he's working as a clown, is given a gun by his coworker. And rightly, I think the writer points to this tool that Arthur can have, because what else is there to protect oneself? This, of course, then piques panic about whether or not the film will draw too much of a conclusion between mental health and gun violence. There are things happening in the film that do counter all of this.
Yeah, I think that the film, its strength and its weakness was how much ground it covered and how it captured so many social anxieties, which seemed a bit absurd because most of the men who commit these mass shootings and the spectacle of them and the power of the spectacle would not be apt to identify with someone who is so vulnerable as this man. I mean, it was agonizing to watch his vulnerability, and you were drawn into that sense of not only righteousness of his impulse for revenge, but how inadequate he was. And I think a lot of the Hollywood characters, the Rambo types that engage in violence, fortify a sense of power that this film really didn't provide. And so it's been much more taken up politically in an iconic way around the world, people wearing those masks, which I think is effective because it's a way of saying, you know, we understand that this is an image that can be used in different ways, but it's not the same as acting out in this crazed identification with the character in the film itself. The issue of violence, I think it did offer some commentary on the false defenses that are provided. And you might say the medications that weren't working, the gun that's provided, all of the ways this man was failed and his grounding and what held him in the world, the relationships that held him, you know, were one by one taken away. I thought a wonderful point you and Victoria made in your review last week, that it's not just about access to mental health services. It's about the ways in which people have some kind of grounding and place in a society, and how people who seem different or odd to others become more isolated and are fair game for those with more power to act out against them.
There's been some interesting discussion, not enough of it, I think, around the question of delusion. As it relates to Arthur particularly, his love of Murray Franklin, desire to become a comic, the way that we all kind of exist in some level of delusion or fantasy about what our lives are.
Being the center of the stage.
Right.
And this whole interest in narcissism and person who is not a narcissist is the one who doesn't question whether they are one. That old
right.
That's actually from Freud.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you got Freud in.
Can't because, quote him
you
enough.
Know, in the old days, it used to be we could find an Oedipal complex anywhere. It's getting harder, I think.
Well, I think this film had a bit of that.
Right.
You and Victoria commented last week that the mother figure in this has not been taken up in the commentary. And, of course, that's a psychoanalytic notion, too. Some of the most important dynamics are at the margin of what you most readily notice, and that's true in film criticism. Often there's some interesting characters and dynamics on the periphery of what we're apt to focus on, like his violence, for example.
Right. Somehow, other than the mother, nobody else is descending into madness in the film, or so we believe. But all of these characters in some way are living through a certain amount of delusion to consent to the conditions of their lives, which takes a lot of mental hijinks to get through day to day.
The speculation on how to diagnose him, is he a this or is he a that, and trying to find a medicalized container for the troubles he has is itself a defense that I think the mental health field has perpetuated, as though if you can just get the right diagnosis, you can contain this. And if you can come up with the right treatment, that you can bring the disturbance under control. And a lot of the quiet everyday suffering, including that's associated with suicide or people not killing themselves necessarily, but slowly dying of various either unhealthy habits or just general unhappiness, general suffering that isn't as dramatic as what we see in mass shootings or isn't as dramatic as we see in a film's denouement, that I think with a film like this, you're aware that there's a lot going on that contributes to the scene of violence. The question of what is wrong with the Joker, how to diagnose him and how to name his problem, is itself a defense. And I think the film itself is more diffuse and circulates in the society more loosely. You know, he interacts with many different people along the way. Some of them help him hold himself together, interactions with people. Others contribute to his undoing. And you can see him doing better or worse, like people who have a serious disorder of some kind or are very disturbed often can be quite rational and be effective in the world under certain conditions. So part of what's problematic about a diagnosis, kind of pinning the right diagnosis on him, is that people are dynamic and shift, and that's why often people do accumulate many diagnoses over time, is sometimes there's something different going on. So here I think his future wasn't totally laid out for us early on, although by the end of the film I think with the scene of the mother having been so abusive, you could say, aha, this is the real reason why he's so troubled and violent. I would like to bring a different reading to the film.
This has been Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking about Joker.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement. I've been your host today. Patricia Kohlberg has been our amazing engineer. I want to say thanks to our guests, Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg, for talking about the Green New Deal and the original New Deal. To Desiree Helligers, talking with Bill Isle, Cowlitz tribal chairman, and Terry Graves, an activist for the Cowlitz tribe, about the Gifford Pinnish National Forest and mining and water issues there. And to Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for continuing this interesting conversation around the film Joker. Since 1968, listeners have relied on real people with real voices to represent their communities on KABU 24 hours a day. We couldn't do this without the support from our listeners and our local business partners. Thanks to all of you that sponsor programs like mine, like this one, the Old Mole Variety Hour. You are a huge part of making this broadcast possible. KABU has a long history of working with local businesses from our community. This November, we are offering businesses 30% off of program underwriting. Program underwriting is affordable, targeted, effective, and aligns your business or organization with KABU's values. You can find out more at kboo.fm/underwriting or by emailing at membership@kabu.org or calling 971-801-1381. Underwriting supports radio that matters. Thank you for supporting KABU. You can listen to The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole in a day or two. The show will be posted with individual segments or the whole show. You can listen to them and share them that way. Please reach out to us, oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. We'd love to have you on the show, be a part of the show, and just hear from you about what you think of the show.